This week, we welcome Matt Radelick, Senior Director, Incident Response and Cloud Operations at Varonis, to discuss It's All About the Data, Understanding Your Blast Radius to Reduce Risk. In the Leadership and Communication section, do you really need a CISO? A CISO employment contract may mean the difference between success and jail. When your employees tell you they're burned out and more, Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is a Security Weekly production for security professionals by security professionals. Please visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to all the shows on our network. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly.
Files are the lifeblood of business, and your employees will open the files they need to do their jobs, whether they're safe or not. With Votero, your employees will only open files that are safe. Votero applies zero trust principles to files and sanitizes every incoming file for your organization. Known and unknown threats are removed instantly, and the file retains full functionality, so your business is safe and productivity never slows down. And it's not just for email. The Votero Cloud API works on web downloads, file uploads, cloud apps, FTP, and content collaboration portals. Learn more at securityweekly.com/Votero. According to the 2022 Data Breach Investigations Report, the human remains the number one driver of breaches today, demonstrating that cybersecurity is no longer just a technical challenge, but a human one as well. But how do you manage the human risks of cybersecurity? It starts with measurement. Only by effectively quantifying human risk can organizations engage employees with relevant activities to truly change human behavior. That's human risk management. Map key human behaviors to the business risks that matter most to your organization for free by visiting securityweekly.com/livingsecurity. Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 307, recorded May 22nd, 2023. I am your host, Matt Alderman. Joining me first from studio, Mr. Jason Albuquerque.
It's good to be back in the studio, Matt. I was able to raid the humidor, got myself a little cigar. It's good. Not celebrating my Celtics, though, because they're blowing it.
Yeah, you and Boston sports these days. Just find a way to
we got to win something, right? It's been way too long. We're championship city here. We got to win something.
And then you traded Brady away, and it all went downhill right after that.
Hey, we don't need any more curses. No. Let's not go there.
Also joining remotely, Mr. Ben Carr. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, Matt. How's it going? Good to be with you guys again today. I'm liking the shirt. I'm wondering if that's just, you're trying to hopefully change the weather that we've been having from all the rain and storms, or if you're actually, feeling sunshine up there today.
It is sunshine in northern Texas today. Yeah, we got a lot of rain this weekend. So I wanted to, be a little more festive.
Nice.
Also joining us, Mr. Tyler Robinson from the great state of Idaho. How are you, Tyler?
Fantastic, Matt. Good to see you. Good to see all you guys. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. Security Weekly listeners, Identiverse is just a few weeks away. Register now and join the digital identity community at the Aria Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, May 30th to June 2nd. The 14th annual Identiverse will bring together over 2,500 security professionals for 4 days of world-class learning, engagement, and entertainment. As a community member, receive 20% off your Identiverse 2023 tickets using code IDV23-SW20. Register today at securityweekly.com/Identiverse 2023. This segment is sponsored by Varonis. To learn more, please visit securityweekly.com/Varonis. Matt Radelick is Senior Director, Incident Response and Cloud Operations at Varonis. He leads a global team of security and cloud experts. His teams help organizations adopt a data-centric approach to securing data from the inside out. Matt, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thanks. It's great to have me here. I also had to mention, I don't think a Bostonian has won the Boston Marathon in over a decade as well. So it's true. Guys do have a lot of,
it is
of
true.
Winning that you have to make up for.
That and Tom Brady and the story of Boston. Sorry. All right. So, Matt, I love this topic because I think I told you in our prep for this, I'm an app user data guy, right? I've been preaching this for years. I mean, it's been at least 8, maybe almost 9, where I've said at the end of the day, the CISO can control really 3 types of security control: the application, the users, and the data. Now, they might own the network. They might not own the network. They might own the endpoint. They might not own the endpoint. Like in cloud worlds, you never know what you own, but you own the applications, the users, and the data. And so I love this triad. And I think it starts, to me, the holy grail, the nirvana has always been protect the data, right? Because that's what attackers are after. Isn't it that simple? Just protect the data.
Yeah. And you can't unbreach it, right? You can restore your network if it gets encrypted. You can restore from backups. You can build a new data center. But once your data gets out, you can't get it back. You can't unbreach data.
Yeah. And unstructured data is that treasure trove that so many organizations, we talk about, you know, say easy, do hard. Containing unstructured data is do hard, because that's the hard act, right? I mean, in just full transparency, I was a Varonis client for a very, very long time. Varonis partner, actually, in a previous life, and, you know, used all of the Varonis product line to help secure our unstructured data. So I love the product line. I love what you guys are about. And I was looking forward to having you on the show today.
And it's not getting any easier, you know, as organizations move data out to the cloud. And I think you said it really well, Matt, like apps, users, and data. That's almost all there is for a lot of organizations. I mean, how many of our viewers, our listeners could get to data without having to be on a corporately managed or owned device and not on a corporately owned or managed network? They can just get straight to those apps and to that data.
Exactly right, which is why I think it's such a critical topic for us to cover. Now, you wanted to wrap this in the concept of the blast radius. Now, I've heard this term used a couple different ways, from a data perspective, from a human perspective. What is the blast radius? Let's define blast radius first, Matt, and then kind of dig into why is it important to understand that, and then how do you protect it?
And if I could answer a third question that you didn't ask, which is how's that different from attack surface management, I'm gonna do that as well, if that's okay with you, Matt.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's
So first and foremost, like, what is it, right? It is the impact of any one thing on your network, user, device, even application, gets compromised. So from a data perspective, you could think about it as, you know, what files and objects can you get to? Which applications can you log into and potentially export data from? I think about things like a Salesforce, which isn't really a unstructured data app, but it's definitely a place that an organization has a lot of critical information. I think about things like, you know, databases or even like your cloud platforms. All these places are, one user gets pumped, which is kind of the average thing that happens, right? We talk about, like, you know, any one user, pull them out of their desk. How much can they access? Is it too much? The answer is most often yes. And that's a little bit different than when you think of attack surface management, which is defining all the things that can be attacked. What I like to do is take the spin of the blast radius. Okay, imagine if any one of those things was attacked, what would the impact be? That's your blast radius. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned something that that's top of mind right now. You know, if an identity gets compromised, right? Obviously, they could pivot into maybe a cloud app or something like that. But what a lot of people aren't thinking about, a lot of organizations aren't thinking about, is folks can run reports out of these systems. We're finding so many clients that we're helping through incident response that they're like, my cloud app, my ERP system, my CRM system, it was not compromised. We know that, right? They did the forensics. But then you start doing scans of the unstructured data and you find all this sensitive information because they were downloading reports. They were running reports that had things like social security numbers in them, things like bank accounts in them. So they're taking this cloud app and bringing information down, saving it on shares, saving it on their endpoints, and they have all of this sensitive data that's just been spawned across their entire network because they're running reports out of these systems. You know, so organizations can't automatically think, no, I'm safe, I'm in the cloud, I know my cloud app wasn't breached. Well, what are your users doing with that data? Are they running reports? Are they saving them? Are they keeping them indefinitely? You know, we found organizations that had 10 years worth of sensitive data in shares, right? And it's pretty scary if you're not thinking about it.
And that problem is only exponentially worse in platforms like Office 365. I think, you know, one of the things that we typically see is probably the number one place where your kind of average user account compromise, you know, phishing email, MFA fatigue, whatever, happens on a person's 365 account. The stuff that they can get to by default, the things that load up in their profile, the things that load up in their inbox, things that load up in the team sites that they have access to, there's probably enough data in there for a ransomware or, you know, kind of, I sometimes it's extortionware these days, actor to take that data out and say, hey, if you don't want me to post it online, you got to pay me a bunch of money. Or it could be detrimental to your business if someone gets in and leaks that information to your competitors. And people overlook this. They tend to think of all cyber attacks as these incredibly sophisticated things that leverage, you know, a string of zero-day exploits or supply chain attacks, when in reality, a regular user can probably just get to too much stuff, which makes you highly susceptible to a data breach, whether or not you have good anti-malware defenses. Yeah.
And let's put it out there. It's not just active users. There are so many organizations who aren't pruning their user base. Like, they're not deactivating users. They're not getting rid of accounts. You know, that we were just working with a customer that had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stale accounts that were active. Right.
And well, the other side to that too, is many organizations, not even just the stale accounts, but many organizations don't even understand or have a means to track what data has been compromised. There's the IR investigation, and as you go through that process, you realize the number of gaps and the inability of most modern environments to really have a grasp of what user data was compromised, much less what corporate data was compromised, and what impact that has long term, and how to begin the mitigation, not just from a technological standpoint, but a PR standpoint, a regulatory standpoint, a disclosure standpoint. All of those things becomes very difficult for most organizations. I think it's kind of lucky that ransomware happens to leak a lot of the information, because then people get an idea of, you know, what information they actually lost. Otherwise, they'd be in the dark for most things.
Well, that's a big problem when you're actually running an incident too, right? It's like, you know what was potentially compromised or exposed if it's a, you know, an external actor and they're telling you, but trying to track down all the potential points and, you know, the things you may have missed, the data that's on the laptop that walked out the door, or, you know, where did that data get downloaded to a cloud service or a third party? It's really difficult to track, you know, and get a holistic sense for where all that information is. And that's what drives a lot of the time frame problem in an incident or a breach response, is trying to figure out what the blast radius is.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's almost as if someone's asking you, what was the blast radius, right?
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. And that's the challenge when you're the CISO sitting in the seat, is trying to figure out, you know, how to give an assurance, you know, to your internal stakeholders, but also to the regulators, and say, you know, we know with assurance that this is the entirety of the information that we have to be concerned with. And the worst thing you can have as a CISO is to have that go public. You make an announcement either publicly or to a regulator, and then a day later, you know, somebody goes, oh, we found this other thing. And you're like, man, okay, now what do we do, right? Because you can't go back a third time. So it's really, really difficult to figure out how to contain and how to understand what that blast radius is.
And there's a lot of benefits to doing it ahead of an incident or before an incident instead of afterwards. I find, like, some of the best security leaders that are well tightly integrated into their businesses actually have this sense of, like, where is my important and where is my sensitive data. They're the ones that tend to prioritize understanding the blast radius before an attack, because they see that, like, hey, most of my organization's risk might actually exist in two or three business units that handle sensitive content or handle M&A or R&D type activity, where that's our intellectual property, those are our crown jewels. And then you can focus your time and attention on securing those most valuable assets as well. There's a lot of tertiary benefits other than just the forensic aspect of understanding the blast radius before an attack.
Yeah, I'll take it even further than that, Matt. It really goes a lot further than that, because when a business unit comes to you and says, we want to do X new thing, if you don't understand what the business unit's doing and you don't understand how they're using data and where that data is, it makes it really time consuming and hard to come back and give a risk assessment of, like, what's the actual risk to the organization of them doing that, or lack of risk, right? And enable them to move quicker. So the more you know where that data is, the more you know how it's being used, the more you know what the context is, it's much more responsive and, you know, I guess timely to interact with the business and be seen as, you know, you're actually contributing to the bottom line as opposed to being a detriment to it.
And Ben, who has access to it today? because yeah, I mean, there's so much permission sprawl. It's sickening, right? Where you're getting really that current state of the crown jewels and who current state baseline, who has access today, and should they have access? Should they not have access? Right. That's
your governance activity, right? I mean, you need to be doing the attestations and saying, okay, I know these five people have access now. Mm-hmm. Should they still have access tomorrow, right? Or on some type of regular schedule basis? Those attestations are critical, right? To make sure you're in compliance and you're doing good governance work.
And I think the other angle here is that this is not an impossible task, right? Like for any listeners, this is great. There's no way I'm going to be able to figure out where my important sensitive data is. I'm going to be able to empower someone with who has access to it today to actually tell me, like, no, you know, Matt, that host from Security Weekly should not have access to the HR folder at this company that he doesn't work for. Mm-hmm. You know, why? How did he get this guest account, or who invited him to that folder? Like, this isn't that complicated, right? There is a lot of automation that's available. I mean, obviously Varonis can help with that, but there's a lot of steps that an organization can take to get this journey started to make it a lot easier for you. Should you have to answer that question? Okay, so we had this incident. Is it a breach?
Yeah. And that's where data stewards come in handy. I mean, this is something that I went through an exercise with Varonis on when we were doing an implementation of Varonis. Start identifying data stewards throughout the organization so they can have the input on what's sensitive, what needs to be confidential, how that security trimming needs to be put in place, right? So, you know, using the tool, identify the data, get those data stewards in there to help you navigate all of that is very important.
I think it helps out from a security culture perspective as well. As we think about like wanting to engage those outside of IT or security, data is a great avenue for that. Right. We're always talking about, well, we need to get the business involved in security. We need to make the average end user aware of the things that they're trying to secure. Well, if you tell them, hey, you actually have access to a million credit card numbers, some of which probably include yours, your family and friends' credit card numbers, and everyone that we do business with, all of a sudden they start to treat their role a little bit differently. But sometimes you have to tell people that. You have to let them know the kind of data that they have to handle and ask them to be a little bit more responsible with it. And that's that data-centric approach to cyber. That's where this helps out. You take that data-first strategy, help get people motivated about the thing that ultimately we're all trying to protect, right? Nobody breaks into a bank to steal the pens. They break in to take money. They break into an organization to steal their data. You gotta focus your protection efforts on that. Because especially as we start to think about like the perimeter eroding away, I'm not sure how many of our listeners, our viewers think that they have this still kind of classic fortified, I can draw a box around it network, but I very, very rarely see those types of organizations anymore.
Yeah, agreed.
How do you think you get organizations started down that journey? Because you look at the M&A process, you look at the evolution of a 20-year-old environment and or the data that's come along with that over 20 years and or the need or ability for many of these companies to have to retain and move this data from, you know, different SaaS applications to different internal applications and keeping it secure and a handle on what is available. What do you think the process and or the mindset needs to be in order to get started on that journey? And then how do you think that organizations that are just getting going can do some of this without making some of the mistakes of the long-standing organizations?
Yeah, first of all, thank you. That's like a really awesome two-part question. One, like, you know, someone who's just getting started, where are they? And two, someone who's just trying to get their arms around it, like, what can they do? What's practical, right? I think it's starting with a risk assessment. So first thing you absolutely have to do is figure out, all right, I know my company is X and we probably have some data on X, Y, and Z. Everybody has employee data that has employees, but like, what's the stuff that like makes your sausage or makes your juice, as I like to say? Where is that data stored? And if you can't figure it out on your own, bringing in someone from the outside to do a risk assessment is definitely an option. That's actually the starting point for every Varonis client or prospective client. The way we go to market is actually through data risk assessments. We offer a free service where we'll come in and take a look at some portion of your on-premise environment, of your cloud environments, and give you that understanding of where is your most critical and sensitive data and where is it the most at risk. And that's a great starting point for like realizing, wow, I actually have this obligation to protect millions and millions of records. I had no idea. Or even, you know, some of the higher risk security findings that we'll see is things like, oh wow, half your employees have, you know, passwords stored in logon.xlsx spreadsheets in their home drives. So you know, lateral movement just became easy. Attackers don't even need to get C2 on a box anymore when someone has a virtual post-it note with all their usernames and passwords on it. And so I'd say for both of those, you know, parties, start with a risk assessment, right? I'm very biased. I would want you to start with a Varonis risk assessment, but at the bare minimum, even you just inventorying where you think this stuff might be and what kind of data you think your company has is going to put you on that first step on that journey for you to understand, like, you know, because a security practitioner, nobody has an unlimited time and unlimited resources. Where do you spend that finite time to get return? It should be where your most valuable data is.
How do you measure? Risk assessments are interesting, right? Low, medium, high. If we're using a qualitative method, but I mean, we know that they're only as good as kind of the inputs that go into those. Is there more of a quantitative way to measure the importance of that data and your blast radius? Because there's so many factors involved, Matt, right? Look, I was going to go down the path of, we haven't done a very good job of understanding our hardware and software assets. Do we really have a good handle on our data assets, which is related to all that, and all the interconnections of that data? Right. So when I do it a basic assessment, if I do it on a qualitative basis, it might give me some focus areas to focus on. But then when you bring in all the intricacies of the interconnection of how you can gain access to data, doesn't that complicate the blast radius calculation and the risk assessment a little more?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about like interconnectivity risk or third-party application risk. That only makes it more difficult. But if I could get us all to agree on one like very simple thing. And I invite you guys to have some discourse here. It's breach risk, right? Like, there are a lot of known regulations, and your organization, whether you feel like you need to be compliant with those regulations or not, might at some point be a processor of regulated data. And so at least being able to understand a qualitative perspective, cost of a data breach per record times the number of records that exist inside of an app, you can get to that low, medium, and high based on a theoretical fiduciary responsibility of that entire app or all of the data within it getting breached. And I think that it is just like a very simple place to start. You haven't even crossed into like your own intellectual property, which might be worth way more than your company than the cost of having to pay per record for a data breach. But if you're just scratching the surface, trying to figure out like where all that regulated data is, or what we call Varonis sensitive data, that can help you determine, and you know, a little bit both quantitative and qualitative, what the net impact of a breach of that asset would be.
Yeah, I mean, you quantified it, right? Number of records, time cost per record breach. That's a quantitative model. Even Doug Hubbard said, any quantitative model is better than a qualitative. And that could be just a simple X times Y equals Z. And that's what you just did. So.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, if you want to get real advanced, get in, you know, you can start thinking about what your annual rate of occurrence is today. And you could do some forecasting. Maybe it's, you know, once every couple of years you have an event like this and involves 10,000 records, and now you're putting dollar signs on it. Yeah. Next thing you know, you're using that as a justification to onboard some new data security platform.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who was a user of Varonis, right? The CIO of an organization that you know, had 6,000 customers. As a user, it, you know, not only were you able to go out and look at all of my data, but you're also able to give me classifications of that data. And then Varonis allowed me to monitor access at a baseline level to see who was accessing that data. So getting that level of visibility of, here's my risk when it comes to social security numbers, X amount, and here are the folks who are accessing all of that data. Then driver's license, right? That was another one. That was a big one. Driver's license numbers. Any type of HIPAA data, right? You start classifying that data out. Now you can get in the realm of, all right, here's what the cost for this type of data would be if it were breached. Now you can start diving deeper and deeper and deeper. And then the other piece too was the monitoring of it. That was a huge benefit to see, you know, baseline, who's accessing these data sets? Who's accessing the sensitive data within my environment? Huge, huge benefit. That visibility was key.
Matt, now that we have the risk assessment, we've got some qualitative or quantitative ways to measure it. I mean, is it simply just now focusing resources to go protect it? Is it that simple? Like, because it sounds simple, but sometimes it's not that simple.
Yeah, so it's really twofold. One, there's a lot that you can get today with automation. So Varonis uses a policy-based automated remediation, or what we call autonomous remediation. we can take something like the walls that an organization wants to put in place. You know, no one should have access to more than this many records, or this many records of a certain sensitive data type can't be exposed externally. And the Varonis robots can keep those policies enforced for you. So in some ways, the effort from you is in the design of those policies or the orchestration of those policies, and then you leave the engineering up to a software platform like Varonis. So it can be really, really easy to get that inventory, have that visibility, and start to reduce that blast radius. And I think for those that might be kind of like listening today and thinking like, I can do that. Like, I can do those things. Maybe they're even already a client and they're starting to think about where that next thing is. I always say is to move from the regulated data to the business sensitive data, because you're going to get some ears perking up in the boardroom when you do that. I think of all of our manufacturing clients where either the way that they make things is in the actual manufacturing process itself, or the formulas, the ingredients of what they make are what give them their competitive edge. Or even in the way that it's packaged or processed. I think of things like you know, law firms, right? Like, you know, not every client's going to give you sensitive data, but some are going to give you really, really sensitive stuff. They might be a very, very high value client to you. You can find out where your business critical data is that next step. And then you're going to really start to see like how much of a more fluent security leader you can be with business leaders when you start to speak in that language.
See, it's not that hard at the end of the day, now is it? It's easy to protect your data. Start with a risk assessment. Understand qualitatively and quantitatively where your most sensitive data is and start to put policies in place to protect it. I mean, done. We just solved it.
If it were only that easy. But no, Matt's absolutely right. It allows you to have the business conversation with business unit leaders. That's the key, right? It helps strengthen that relationship across the business, because now you have visibility into where the most sensitive information in your business is. Now you can go back to that leader and start talking about who needs access to this when. Here's the risk it's bringing to the organization, and now you engage them in helping you control that, helping you protect it. Now they're embedded in the security conversation, in the risk conversation.
Yeah, they understand that you're not just reading their email all the time. They're starting to think like, wow, this person's like actually trying to help my business unit keep doing what it's doing, keep making money. Or if you're a hospital, delivering patient care, right? Like you end up feeling this sense of empowerment, and people want to work with you because you've now quantified for them, hey, you know, you got 100 employees that can access all this stuff. Like, do you really need 100 people to be able to get to, you know, the secret recipe for our soft drink?
And I think there's some benefits too, adjacent benefits, right? It helps me start to identify where my critical key partners are, where my data is, right? It's maybe all stored in a cloud provider that I have a high concentration on. It overlaps into other protection areas as well, but it starts with where is the data, how sensitive is it, and how do I protect it? And without understanding those basic things, that's why I think asset management is so important for organizations. You can't protect what you don't know. So figure out what you have and then figure out how to go protect.
Yeah, that's why I was going to jump in. First control in the CIS top 20, right?
Yep.
Yeah, you completed my thought on that, Matt, was, you know, it really goes back to what you referenced earlier of asset management, right? This is just another asset classification category, right? Where data is just an asset that you have to look at, like, what's the value of that asset to the organization? What's the value of losing that asset to the organization, right? And if you don't understand that asset in its entirety, how it interplays with all the other assets in the organization, there's no way you can protect it. So, I mean, I think it's uber important to understand that in the relationships.
And it's only getting tougher. Introducing these new technologies like AI, who can go through and scan all of your data and use it in its data set, use it in its training models. Well, should it be?
And should you allow it to be, right?
Like, should it be? That's the question.
Or do you need to keep
right?
it out of that data set?
So it's only going to get more complicated now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think interconnectivity risk is going to drive that a lot too, right? We're only going to become, our apps are only going to talk to each other more. Our business leaders are only going to have the ability to sign up new apps and share data with new places. I think that's going to happen far more frequently in the future than it does now. And we're never going to be able to undo that the progress or the pace of innovation that's happening.
Yeah. We started the segment by trying to define the difference between attack surface monitoring and kind of discovery and the blast radius. And what I think is important is understanding where the data is to identify when somebody gets in, because they will get in. Look, it's inevitable. We see this all the time, right? The human compromise is real. And understanding where data is and how to gain access to it and prevent it and protect it is a huge part that the attack surface monitoring doesn't do, because it's just telling you, like, these are the systems I can gain access to, not thinking about the human element at all. So I think this is something that's very important for people to get their arms around, because now I can start to prioritize resources, budget, dollar, people, whatever, to actually figure out how to protect data where it's at. Matt, any final thoughts on that?
No, that was so eloquently stated, Matt. I think I would just want to reiterate the point that if you're listening to all this and you just, like, you don't even know where to start, risk assessment, like a free risk assessment from Varonis, can definitely help you out with that. There's no obligation to move forward with that. And it will give you this snapshot of, like, wow, I actually have some really important data that I should shift some resources to try to protect.
Yes, absolutely. Matt, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Yeah, it was an honor to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
To learn how to limit your blast radius, please visit securityweekly.com/Varonis. We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week. How do you win the race against risk and safely lock down your cloud data without hiring an army of administrators? Introducing Least Privilege Automation, only from Varonis. Varonis eliminates data exposures while your employees work and while they sleep, making intelligent decisions about who needs access to data and who doesn't. Our cloud-native solution analyzes permissions and sharing links, monitors access activity, and classifies sensitive data. Because Varonis knows who can and who does access critical data, our automation safely remediates risky links and permissions. Learn more at securityweekly.com/Varonis. Mimecast has released its State of Ransomware Readiness Report for 2022, finding that most cybersecurity leaders experience the same or increasing numbers of ransomware attacks over last year. Together with Mimecast, organizations can stand strong in the face of cyber attacks, human error, technical failure, and work protected. Mimecast, work protected. Visit securityweekly.com/Mimecast to learn more.
Application Security Weekly delivers interviews and news from the worlds of AppSec, DevOps, and all the other ways people find and fix software flaws. Join us as we explore how the latest news highlights modern security practices or reminds us of the missing ones. We also bring insights from interviews on topics from training to threat modeling, from open source tools to cloud native techniques, plus an occasional reference from New Wave to Synth Wave. Find us at securityweekly.com/subscribe or look for Application Security Weekly wherever you pick your podcasts.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Jason Albuquerque, Ben Carr, and Tyler Robinson. Our teams from Security Weekly and SC Media were on-site at RSA Conference 2023, delivering in-depth reporting, analysis, and interviews from the conference. If you were unable to join us in person or didn't manage to catch our video live stream from Broadcast Alley, you can access all of our RSA C 2023 coverage at securityweekly.com/RSAC. All right, gentlemen, it has been a few weeks since we've done articles because we've been doing all the interviews from RSA Conference. So I had a lot to choose from. And we're going to have this beautiful little theme of some CISO topics to start with, to start our leadership discussion. And this first article reminded me of one of the sessions at RSA Conference that I unfortunately did not get a chance to attend, which is this concept of, do you really need a CISO? Because there are a lot of organizations that actually don't have CISOs listed as part of their leadership team, and they're publicly traded companies. Mm. So do you really need a CISO, Jason? Ben?
Well, I guess from a title perspective, maybe not. From a responsibility perspective, absolutely. You need someone who's going to be in charge of, we were just talking about, data security, the security of the organization, managing risk, managing your technology risk. There needs to be someone at the helm. Absolutely. Maybe the title isn't CISO. Maybe it's a chief risk officer. Maybe it's, some other title, but from a responsibility and accountability perspective, absolutely. Whether it's on staff or someone you bring in, we see a lot of VCISOs, virtual CISOs coming in, right?
Yeah, I don't know how in today's world you don't, especially right. given the upcoming SEC proposed changes, right? Regulatory issues, the breaches that we've seen. How can you not? I mean, it always surprises me when you talk to a company that's been around for a while or is publicly traded, and they don't have someone, or we've got a director that does it, right? Or we've got somebody in the IT organization. It's not
no.
It doesn't pass muster, right? I mean, if you're a stockholder, if you're investing, like, you should be asking these questions, right? If you're a company that's going public and you don't have somebody, I mean, I would be really concerned if it was me, especially given today's environment. Now, the virtual CISO, yeah, I mean, companies of a certain size, it's hard to justify, but you still need somebody who has right. overall responsibility for it, whether you outsource that to virtual capacity yeah. or have somebody on site. But you got to have somebody. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
And somebody who has a voice to leadership, right? Because one of the things that blew my mind in this article is it says only 12% of CISOs have a seat at their company's board of directors. That was that blew my mind that they don't have that ability.
I took it a different way, Jason, because it says have seats on their company's boards of directors. And I find that shocking that 12% actually have a seat on the board of directors. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I don't see that.
Yeah, maybe
I don't see that.
Maybe I read that wrong.
So maybe it was written poorly, and what they meant was, have a seat at the table with the board of directors. I wouldn't be surprised by that stat, right? I think that's low, and I think every CISO should be talking with the board of directors, and every CISO should be considered part of executive staff, right? It's Agreed. Just whether virtual or not. If you don't have that voice in the room, how do you know you're making the right business decisions? Like, you wouldn't have your CSTAF get together without your CFO, without your legal officer, right? Like, I don't get it. So yeah, that stat blew me away, and I'm hoping it was worded wrong and that's not what they meant. But if it is, I wanted to see those people and talk to them and understand how they got there, because right. I'm not seeing it in general practice.
And said I think that's the biggest issue, right? Is having that voice at the table. Whether you have a director that's filling that role in or an IT, that doesn't mean they have the same the same executive voice. They don't have the same meeting schedule. They may not even have the same purview into budgets, roadmaps, and or the business strategy from a strategic standpoint. Like, who's guiding the security and technology? Almost all companies now should be considering themselves a technology company, and therefore that means they have to have technology initiatives, which means they should be having security initiatives. Each one of those without a voice at the table then becomes a secondary and tertiary goal and roadmap for every other department. A CFO is not going to be thinking foremost and not allocating budget and having that first level of interaction in order to build those strategies and get that advice and consult those conversations. Yeah. So without that voice, I don't think any company can run in today's technological environment.
Right. And again, to get back to the article, do you need the title CISO? No. Do you need someone who has those responsibilities and accountable and has that communication line directly to leadership? Absolutely. 100%. Tyler, you said it. I mean, if the pandemic did anything, it turned every company into a technology company. Everything. Restaurant business, hospitality business. It doesn't matter what vertical you're in anymore. You're a technology business.
Yeah, I think we take for granted sometimes, like, the nuance that we understand that other people who might not be in it don't understand, right? And in the same way that, like, we wouldn't understand necessarily all the nuance of finance or all the nuance of legal in those discussions, right? We may have more than the average understanding of somebody, but we don't understand it in the level of that same detail. So I want to be clear, and, you know, Tyler's, and I agree with you, like, does it need to have that title? No, it doesn't need to. But what it isn't is, it, like, the CISO role is not a technologist role. Mm-hmm. It's someone who has an understanding of technology and can play in that realm, but it's not a technologist, right? It's someone who can bring technology into the realm of business and understand the business perspectives, which is why, in my mind, it's so critical to have somebody who is sitting at that table, can understand business, but can apply technology in the right way to get the right business outcomes.
Mm-hmm. So here, this is the little nuance in this article that I wanted to get this debate going, right? Look, if I'm a chief information security officer, but I do not have a seat at the executive leadership position, what good is that? Versus having a director or a vice president that does actually have a seat at the executive leadership that has the responsibilities. I think sometimes the title is loaded, right? And we have this thing called chief in it, Therefore, everybody assumes it's an executive leadership position, but in some organizations, it's actually not.
Right.
And I think that does this position a disservice, because I agree with all of you. The responsibilities have to be there. I don't care about the title, but some people care about the title without the right reporting structure, and I think it just hurts.
Absolutely. There are folks with the chief in their title that are so far down the org chart that their communication gets filtered. It's the game of telephone by the time it gets to leadership, right? And that's not what we can afford. We can't afford to have the game of telephone. We can't afford for our communications to be filtered three times before it hits leadership. Because it's other people's motivations and perspectives that it gets filtered.
It takes experience, right, Jason? I mean, like, I think a lot of people get into this in their first time out. They go for an interview for a CISO role or the person who's responsible for security in the organization. And there'll be those opportunities where somebody say, this role reports to a guy who reports to the CIO.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no. Like,
right.
That's a hard one for me.
Then
like,
the CIO reports to the CEO, right?
Right. The COO who that's reports
right.
to the CEO.
That's right.
And he doesn't, and the CIO doesn't have general all the time participation in the C-staff. So you've got to have those dialogues up front. And I think companies need to be aware of that too. And look, the more people that they see that are like, yeah, I'm not going to take that job. Mm-hmm. Like it'll start to have repercussions in the company. Like maybe we're approaching this the wrong way. And if you're working as a recruiter, you got to work with the right recruiters who understand this role. There's specifics to it, right?
The sad part about it, Ben, is that when the stuff hits the fan, who's the first head on the chopping block?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, they exactly. may be, you know, three tiers filtered down, but whose neck is on the line? That's
the sad like part. It's a bad place to be when you're talking to customers and it's like, what are you going to say? Like, I couldn't make any of those decisions because I actually don't have the authority.
Right.
Like, you can't say that, right? You're throwing the company under the bus. That mm-hmm. isn't going to work. So you're taking it on the chin and that's why CISOs have this reputation of being the first to get hit when, you know, bad stuff happens to the company. And so I think all that needs to change. And there's some other articles like later on that we'll talk about that I think just reinforce that and the discussions that you need to have when you're thinking about this role, and companies need to elevate where they think about this position. You don't have 80 C-level executives, but you do need somebody responsible for security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So that leads into number two, because you guys started to go there already, and that is how an employee contract can actually save the CISO from success and or potential jail time. Now, this is an article off of the Joe Sullivan case on how to protect the CISO. This article is great because it spells out what you should have in your employee contract if you want to go in to be that guy.
Yeah,
right.
And one of the main bullet points is clear understanding of roles, responsibilities, and reporting. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is one of the major bullet points in this article. Definitely. That's what we just talked through.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and I think far too people even are thinking at the who are going into the C-level roles that aren't the CFO, chief legal, mm-hmm. And the CEO. Those are the three that everybody thinks about. But like when you start to think about, you know, the CISO and the level of responsibility and now the level of potential regulatory or legal action that someone can take against you or just shareholder suits, right?
Yep.
You need to think about, what are they doing as far as, litigation? How are you covered by D&O insurance? Do you have an employment contract? So if something happens and you are the scapegoat, do you have some type of parachute on the backside? Are you thinking mm-hmm. about, continued medical coverage? Are you thinking about, how are they going to cover lawsuit costs? Those kind of things. I mean, all those things are really, really important, and you need to negotiate that up front.
That's
table stakes.
I mean, huge is directors and officers insurance. Like you have to make sure that you're on that. That's in this day and age, absolutely. You need to be sure that you're held harmless.
Answer would be, well, if you're working for the company, you're covered. No, you're not. Like that's not the way it works.
No. you have to be
a named officer mm-hmm. of the company. To be covered by D&O, and it can get really expensive.
Yeah, which goes back to the previous article. It is not considered an officer in a lot of them because they're not at the executive level, so mm-hmm. they're not named in the D&O policy.
Right,
right. That's one of the challenges.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're in that watered down reporting structure, you're not going to be on the D&O. There's no way. It's not going to happen, right? And you know, the other piece too that I really like that this article called out is the whistleblower protection. Because if things are smelling funny and you need to raise your hand, you should be able to. Without risk.
Yes. Ask the FBI how that's going these days.
Right.
Just say,
I get it.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%, Jason. Because look, if something's not going as planned or something doesn't look right, you should be able to bring it up, get protection mm-hmm. to get it addressed and fixed. But that doesn't always happen either, even when you have whistleblower protection.
Right, right. True, true.
Well, but it's also just internally, like in how the roles negotiated and what your understanding of the responsibilities are, right? Do you report to the CEO? Do you report to the CIO? Like if an incident is happening, do you have direct relationship with the board where you can go out of band and say, hey, look, I have concerns about this. This is an issue and I feel a responsibility to report on this, right? To somebody at the board level. And if it's above that, you know, report externally if you really need to, if it's a legal issue. But I mean, all that needs to be understood. So there's clear understanding when the stuff hits the fan. Mm-hmm. What do you do? How do you do it? Right? Are you going to feel comfortable in doing the right thing? And you know, you need to have ethics and morality in this part of the business as well. I mean, if you don't, you're not going to get very far.
Yeah.
So I think companies will generally respect that. And if they don't, if you're having those conversations and you're not getting the right answers, that's a red flag. Like maybe it's not the right fit then.
Yeah. And Ben, you touched on it a little bit. You know, it's not only having these things in place for while you're there, but also having provisions in place for your exit strategy, right? Because one big thing could be a non-compete or a non-disclosure clause that you're going to be held to, mm-hmm. right? You know, if you have a non-compete, you may not be able to go work for another like company. You need to pay attention to all the language in your employment agreement, like things like non-compete and non-disclosure. You want a non-disclosure in place because if something were to go down, you don't want the company to speak bad about you or anything like that, right? So you got to have some of these things in place.
Yeah, and that's part of what you look for on your exit contract, right? You negotiate it ahead of time, but in the exit, right, you say, you know, if I'm terminated without cause, then you know my non-compete goes away.
That's right.
Right? On termination. So those are things that everybody needs to think about. Mm-hmm. Like it's just again, it's got to be table stakes for CISO level discussions. And the more everyone is talking about this, and everyone is coming with these things to the table, it will become the standard and people won't get pushback, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it makes it, the more informed we all are, the better the holistically we'll be in these negotiations.
So Ben, even defining for cause is something you have to look at.
Yes. Yeah.
Like what is considered cause?
You have to say what is for cause. Yes. Yeah.
It's going to be called that's out. Right. That's right. It's going to be specified.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be caught in a for termination for cause of something that's out of your control mm-hmm. because you don't have the authority to deal with it. Like you got to look at all those clauses.
I've gotten very specific in the language that's in stuff I talk about. Yeah. Because you have to. Look, nobody likes this, right? But like the last thing you want to be is in some type of litigation with something that's unclear. And so you want to make sure you feel that you're protected. And my advice is consult an attorney. There are specific attorneys in this field. Not the security necessarily,
yeah.
But in the employment contract law where you can talk to somebody and you know they'll be able to advise you on the specifics mm-hmm. and review contracts and look at all of that. It's a piece of the legal practice. It's not some oddball thing.
And you want to know what? It's much easier to have these conversations as you're courting, right? As you're courting with each other than to go a year or two and then have to revisit it. That's a hard conversation, right? So the time is now. If you're looking at a job, you haven't been hired yet, and you're still in that courting phase, now is the time to start having those conversations and negotiating.
That being said, I've heard of a couple instances, Jason, where somebody I know, CISO, who's done this a couple times, didn't have one in place, and somebody came to him they were having kind of an offsite meeting. He said, you know, look, we're really happy. We love that you're here mm-hmm. and all. Like, you know, are you feeling comfortable? Is there anything? And he brought that up at that time and said, yeah, you know, look, this is one thing that concerns me. And they mm-hmm. were, you know, they liked the relationship with him and they said, you know, look, we want to make you comfortable and we don't want you to feel like you're going to go somewhere else or you're going to have to look around. So he was able to put that in midterm, right?
That's great.
But yeah, it's much, much easier if you do it on the front side.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I have similar stories, Ben, of people who have merged with companies, played that role, and then decided not to take that role because they wouldn't get those protections mm-hmm. in the new combined organization, right? So
yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And look at it, like, that should be like in a change of control situation. What happens, right? How do you handle that? Yeah. I know another person who change of control happened, and they had a, you know, there was a window. She had accelerated vesting outside of that window. And so, you know, if you can look at those things, negotiate as much as you can upfront. Mm-hmm. And, you know, realize that when you're talking about a C-level position, it's expected that some of this stuff is going to be negotiated and talked about, right? It's not just about your annual comp and your bonus anymore. Yeah. There's a lot more to, is the role the right role for you and for the organization? Yeah. And, you know, everybody has to feel comfortable in it. You want to, you know, if you're making hard calls and hard decisions, the last thing you want to worry about in terms of a breach is, oh, geez, what happens on the backside of this?
Right.
Right. And that's the last thing the company wants, too. That's something you should talk about with them and say, you know, look, if things are going south and we're having a massive incident, you don't want my mental capacity 70% involved in the breach and 30% involved in, like, how am I landing softly after this? Right. You want me 100% focused on how do we solve this problem we're having right now? And I know no matter what happens, I'm taken care of on the backside. Mm-hmm. And hopefully for everybody, it's, you know, things go well, the breach happens, you're still employed and everything goes right. But if it's not, yeah, you just don't want that bifurcated mental effort going on in those high stress times, which is why these things get negotiated.
Yeah, absolutely. One of your strategies was to go talk to the board, but article number 3, mm-hmm. board CISO collaboration still under 50%. I mean, the SEC may change some of this, but Even if you got whistleblower protections, to be able to go to the board, do you have a relationship with the board that you could even have that outreach and conversation with? I mean, there's still a gap here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Again, these numbers are staggering, right? It says approximately a third of board members only see CISOs at board presentations. They have no relationship with the CISO outside of a board presentation. Only 50% regularly, you know, of board members regularly interact with the CISO. That shows that there's not a strong relationship between the cybersecurity risk leader and the leadership of the company.
Yeah, and I think it's both surprising and unsurprising. So the surprising side for me is if you talk to most public companies or even private companies and you do an analysis of their risk, right, and you look at their risk matrix, you'll find often that cyber or, you know, the security risk side of it is often the number one, if not, it's always in the top three, right, of the risks. So you would think that the board would say, if this is our number one risk or in the top three, I want to know all about it. But I think generally they're somewhat uninformed, right? And they're counting on it being handled by somebody, and that could be the CIO or some other exec who they've normally dealt with in the past. And so there's not necessarily that relationship. And then on the C-level side for the CISO, I think you have a lot of people who are new to the game. And so they're not used to the difference in the role of a CISO versus a VP of security, right? And that C-level role has a different responsibility matrix, and you need to interact with the board. And one of the things that somebody told me once, and I really think this is really smart advice, is you need to find one person on the board who you can have a relationship with. And what does a relationship mean? It doesn't mean like you talk to them in the board meeting. Mm-hmm. It means outside of that meeting, you're having somewhat regular conversations. Maybe you're just grabbing a coffee with them. Yep. Maybe you're going out to dinner once in a while with them. You're talking generally about the business, right? But you're also, in a way, almost using them for mentoring, right? Because you're hopefully you're in a CISO level, you have aspirations to keep going further. And so what does that look like? What does board level participation look like? Utilize them. The more you ask questions, the more you seem interested in what they're doing, the more it's going to be a mutual relationship and not just, yeah, this person's here to try to get more money out of us, right? And try to figure out how to get more investment. You should think about things outside of the investment portfolio, and then you're developing a true relationship. And then when you have a problem, you can call them up on the phone and say, hey, Bob, I've got some concerns about this, right? Can we walk through some scenarios? Now you're playing the game. Now you're involved with the board of directors. 100%. So I don't know, Jason, what your thoughts on that?
All day long. I have a standing meeting every other week with a board member. Every other week, where it could be as simple as us jumping on a Teams meeting for a half an hour and doing a gut check with each other or going to grab dinner. It's a have to have. It's a must have. And then the beauty of it is when there are struggles on either side, right? I need help understanding this. You can help them understand. You can help clarify. You can help, you know, bring them to the table and get clarification to them. But it's also when you're struggling with getting something done, so many times the board member's gone off and said, let me reach out to this person, that person, this person. And by the next morning, things are solved. Things are on their way. Things are moving forward. You're getting the help you need. Right. So, yeah, I mean,
like, hey, I don't understand why Susan said that in the board meeting. You can't go to Susan, but you can maybe go to Bob, and Bob will tell you, here's the backstory on that's going and what was really meant. And you didn't get the context of it because you're not involved in those other decisions. It's almost like that. It's the red phone between Russia and the U.S., right? Where you can just pick it up and de-escalate.
Being able to navigate the politics of the business.
Yeah.
Throwing a simple question out there, asking why. That can help you navigate the politics. Well, this is why this person typically has a stance like this. And here's some advice on how to maybe communicate this a little bit differently for that type of a personality, right? And it gets you those conversations. Half an hour every other week is worth its weight in gold for me.
Yeah. And then before you go into the board presentation, right? Like, hey, can you look over these two slides? Because I just don't know how it's going to hit.
You can preemptively throw your pitch out there in that half an hour and see what kind of result you're getting. Absolutely.
Yeah, that would pay off massive units.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 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 yes. You guys are doing a great job. Like I told you, I kind of teed them up this week. Like, it's been a few weeks. I got you guys going.
We're not passionate or anything, Matt.
Nah, not even a little bit.
Not even a little bit. Next article on the CISO trail is CISOs pushing for mental health in cybersecurity. Like, finally? Like, the role has a lot of stress associated to it. Okay, look, you're not a surgeon and people are sitting on the table ready to die, but it is still a pretty stressful position.
Very. Extremely stressful. We've been talking about this for 4 years on this show.
Yeah, we talked about this in the second article, right? You're negotiating for a personal counselor in your employment contract, right? Just to your therapist, couch time, half hour a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's mental health for CISOs, but the whole security org, right? I mean, it can be super stressful. You got to figure out how to not burn yourself out, and how to not burn your team out. It's really hard.
Yeah. And in the leadership position, it's extremely important that you take care of yourself. You cannot take care of a team and lead a team if you're not good yourself. So you have to look at yourself. You have to make sure you're in a good spot. And again, when statistics get thrown out here, like 91% of CISOs saying they suffer moderate or high stress, that's an alarm for me, right? It's 60%. Yeah. They don't disconnect at all. That's a huge risk. Huge, huge risk.
And when you do disconnect, like that's when everything happens, is when you disconnect.
Yeah, right.
Like you're on vacation and you get a call that a breach happened, inevitably. So, we talk a lot about the number of people that want to get into the role, but Jason, I would assume you'd agree with me that like I'm amazed that anyone sometimes wants to get into the role because the amount of conflicting interest and stress and tension that goes with it.
Agreed.
Yeah. With the reward comes risk, and sometimes that is mental health. And
you call
burnout.
It the blessing and the curse of being in the role.
Yeah, exactly right. We're going to talk burnout in a second. I do want to cover this article quickly, how cybersecurity is impacting another chief executive title, chief supply chain officer.
Where does that sit in the organization? Where in the org chart is that, Matt?
I'm pretty sure it's under procurement, under
that's
finance.
An IC six levels down. Yeah. Everybody needs but a what chief. Go ahead, Matt. Sorry.
I was just going to say, having built a third-party risk management process and managed it for a large national bank, what I think is interesting in this article is we're not thinking about other aspects of the supply chain. Mm-hmm. Third-party risk management programs don't necessarily think about all the other components from a supply chain perspective. And what this article is basically saying is, look, we have to probably revamp our processes a little bit. Mm-hmm. You think? Like the last 3 years should be pretty eye-opening for most 100%. People that we got a supply chain issue.
Right. And more and more of that supply chain is technically technology-oriented. More and more.
On some level, everything, right? Like just shipping the toilet paper to Walmart is like, there's a technical problem to that. And like, what happens if that gets disrupted and people can't get toilet paper? I mean, it's a massive problem. And there was an interesting stat in here, 98% of businesses employing fewer than 500 employees. Like, how does anyone afford a chief supply chain officer, much less the chief security officer at that point?
Right.
But
right.
The majority of their business is technical, so you've got to have people who understand that. So the virtual CISOs, or using third parties or outsourced, mm-hmm. But yeah, it's got to be done. And third party risk is a massive problem for most people. So it's a huge blind spot
for organizations.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, especially small organizations that don't have mm-hmm. overall control or understanding of where all these relationships are. Right, you walk into a small organization, they've got all these different software providers all over, but you've never figured out. Back to our first segment, who's got what data? Like, I don't know where half of my data is. It's sitting in different systems. Is it sitting in HubSpot? It's sitting over some other system over here. They're all outsourced little vendor relationships that no mm-hmm. one's done a risk assessment on.
Right.
And that's before you get into your core software and hardware assets as part of your supply chain.
Yeah, I can guarantee you if I was a betting man, I could make money on betting on how many businesses with 500 or fewer employees have good inventory or asset management and understand the third-party risk chain. Like, it's a zero.
Absolutely. Last article, quickly. Maybe not quickly. I mean, this is an article about mm-hmm. employee burnout. It is real. It's real in our industry, especially. And I think as leaders, we have to take this concept of employee burnout very seriously. I've seen it transpire through different individuals that have worked for me in the past, and what it does to those individuals. And mm-hmm. eventually, they leave. They go somewhere else. Right. Sometimes they just completely disconnect for a while. Like, this is a real thing. And I think as leaders, we have to be cognizant of looking for signs and figuring out how to help our employees as they hit some of these burnout
phases. And we have to be very responsible with it, because I'm hearing stories of folks completely leaving the industry because of burnout. It turns them off completely from being in cybersecurity. I'm getting out of the industry. We can't be losing talent, right? We can't be shedding talent because of burnout, because of stress, because of anxiety. You know, it's got to be part of our policies and our strategies for retaining personnel, is thinking about that burnout.
Well, I'm really interested in your thoughts on a question here. I'll pose it. Like, do we really understand burnout with regard to cyber, and is it the same as every other piece of the organization? And what I mean by that is, look, everybody's burnout in New York, right? Especially, sure. Over the last couple of years with COVID, salespeople were burnout because it was a different way of doing business, right? People in HR and the finance are burnout because they've got less resources to deal with, and it's a challenge figuring out how to change stuff. While that's true, I would say that cyber is one of those areas of the organization, and maybe legal a little bit, depending. I've seen it happen in parts of in different companies based on this as well. Is that we're facing burnout from two sides. One is just the stress and the same thing that the rest of the organization is dealing with, and change of business and transformation and just normal business issues. But also, there's a large number of organizations where a large percentage of the business doesn't like the security organization. And that may sound strong, but it's this pushback of man, they're always trying to stop us from doing stuff. They want to slow down sales. They want to, mm-hmm. Make it more difficult for us to send the HR data across the network. We're trying to take a responsibility to protect the business, but it's often perceived in this almost adversarial way. And so the burnout is almost compounded because
it is.
You're dealing with all the normal stress, and then you're like, man, nobody likes me. This is a rough job, and everybody thinks I'm trying to be the a-hole. And it's not true. We're trying to do our job. And that lack of feeling like we're on the same team, we're fighting the same good fight, I think really compounds the burnout
problem. It doubles the anxiety because not only you're saying, I'm identifying an issue, I want to help solve this issue, but when you're not empowered to actually help resolve the issue, that doubles the anxiety because now you know there's this risk, right? That you're not getting support from the business in remediating the risk, but now go back up to those previous articles, you're responsible for it. If something bad were to happen, now there's a level of responsibility. So now you're feeling that weight on your shoulders, that you're responsible for this thing that the business will not support you in remediating. That doubles
and
the anxiety.
And that risk doesn't ever go away, right? You're always in this fight or flight situation mm-hmm. where there's never a period of downtime. There's never not something to do. There's not a end of a sales cycle, end of a quarter. All of those things don't exist in the security industry and the risk to the business. So mm-hmm. the consistent responsibility, that consistent pressure, and the consistent need to always be doing something because there is always something to do yep. in order to mitigate all of those things. I think that that makes it very difficult for people to wrap their heads around if they're not, if they've not done this for a very long time. Mm-hmm. You get to that 5-year mark and you really start to understand like there is no break unless you make a break, and that responsibility has to be set up properly in order to pass that risk to someone else to take a break so that you don't burn out.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult for many people to do.
Yeah. And then every time there's a bump in the night, you're going to get the pit in your stomach. Yep. Any bump in the night, you're going to be stressing. Right? Because you know you didn't get support from the business to remediate the risks that are out there.
Yeah. And for those who haven't done it, I mean, it's like going to a party on a 20-story building and it's on a rooftop deck and there's a cable rail around the deck and everybody's having a drink and the head of sales is sitting against the side of it. You notice that the cable's broken and you went and said, "Hey, Bob, hey, watch out. The cable's broken. You're going to fall off the back." He would thank you. But if it's a security risk, mm-hmm. he's going to go, "Shut up, like stop bothering me," right? And it's the same equivalency of risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the other thing is the impact of a failure on the security side has some pretty dramatic consequences that I don't know that other parts of the business necessarily have the pressure of as well. So yeah. I think it even gets compounded a little more because of a data breach to certain organizations could mean the end of certain organizations. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, the stakes are pretty high on top of everything you guys just described.
It could mean shuttering the doors variable. Of your business. It could mean shuttering the doors of your business, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, from a leadership side of the aisle and just being able to get in tune with your staff, you know, it's, I think I've said this on the show before, I have an uber eagle eye on utilization of employees. And it's not utilization from a productivity standpoint. It's utilization from a burnout standpoint. If I see folks who are not dedicating time to training, to professional development, to mentorship, and they're constantly working the job, that's a red flag. I've had conversations with my directors and managers. That person, you got to tell them next Friday, their day next Friday off, like it or not. They want to go study, they can go study. If they want to do something related to, you know, professional development, cool. They're off the clock. They're off the clock. Yeah, they're not available on Teams.
I think
Teams.
That's super important.
Right?
People won't self-identify, right? No. Like you've got to know as a leader that you have to be able to identify those or get your management teams to identify them.
And you get folks who are workhorses and they want to be highly utilized and they want to work hard and they want to be the ones up at 11 o'clock at night helping a client. But at some point you have to realize it's going to have a tipping point and you need to get in front of that so the burnout does not happen. So proactively looking at utilization and saying, you've been 110% utilized for the last 2 weeks. Go take a couple of days off. Go.
And that's super hard because we're all sensitive to budgets, right? But I mean, I think when you look at your budget, you really have to be building utilization tables to make sure you've got that 10-20% built in.
Yep.
And you're not, if you're utilizing it 100%, you're going to burn your people out and it's going to fail.
Exactly.
Have a bad program.
And you want to know what? Even from a budgetary perspective, it's going to hit my budget if I lose that great employee.
That's right.
It's going to affect my budget. It's going to affect how my company can operate, how my teams can operate. It's going to have an adverse effect. I'd rather be ahead of it.
It's cheaper.
In the long run, it really is. Replace, ramp them up. Yes. All the things that happen. Gentlemen, always a pleasure. I'm glad we got back to articles. So much, such a fun discussion. Thank you everyone for watching and listening. We'll see you next week. Oh wait, 2 weeks on Business Security Weekly. Next week's Memorial Day.